Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind everyone that we are Zooming on Tuesday afternoon, so if something should happen Tuesday night, you'll have to wait till the end of the week for us to discuss it. You know the drill. We begin our show every single day, except for two, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. It was about talking truth to power. It was the voice of a patriot. It was the voice of a celebration of immigration. Now, the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So joining us right now is Richard Wolff. He is an American Marxist economist known for his work on economic methodology and class analysis. He is a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School in New York. He has taught economics at these prestigious institutions, Yale University, Sydney University of New York, University of Utah, University of Paris, and the Brecht Forum in New York City. He is also the author of many books. I love the title of your newest book, so I have to start there. The sickness is the system. When capitalism fails to save us from pandemics or itself. So let me welcome to the program, Professor Wolff. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So I was thinking about the pandemic and whether capitalism will ever have the capacity to address it in an effective way and recognizing that this is not going to be the only pandemic we're going to be facing going into the future. But before we get into the sickness is the system and also looking at how fascism has converged with capitalism, which is your other piece at Salon.com, I guess I have a question. Is capitalism, do you think, capable of dealing with climate change either? I mean, I'm looking at what the driver of climate change was, and I like do an homage to capitalism. Then I'm looking at the destruction of climate change, and I'm looking at capitalism going, since you brought it to us, how the hell are you going to solve it? So I think as we're looking at the pandemic, that's just a walk in the park compared to what we are facing into the future. And if we don't address the sickness in the system, we are really going to be addressing a kind of failure that is almost incomprehensible.
Well, you know, I've been asked that question many times. And what I do now is I kind of come back and question the question. And let me explain.
All right.
In some abstract way, I suppose I shouldn't exclude from total possibility that capitalism might in some manner, way, shape, or form come to terms with pandemics, with business cycles, with climate disaster. But for me, the question is, yeah, maybe it could, but why are we discussing this? I don't like capitalism. I'm not interested in saving it. I'm interested in facing the reality that it has failed to deal with its business cycles and the enormous social cost of each of them. It has failed to deal with this pandemic. It has failed to deal with climate change in our country. It has failed to deal with the horrendous treatment of African Americans as an important minority in our society. I mean, this is a list of failures which in any rational universe would have led to the question, why do we have a system that racks up such overwhelming failures. Why are we busy trying to figure out how can we possibly solve these problems without abandoning capitalism? Abandon it already. There's no reason not to. You know, what is this? Every system in human history, slavery, feudalism, ancient tribal, every system you can point to was born, evolved over time, and then it died. Capitalism is just another system. We know it was born. We know it's evolved over time. Therefore, we know what the next step is. And what we're seeing, in my judgment, around us are the signs that the last stage is upon us. And we should be courageous enough to say, look, it is not appropriate. It just isn't to face all of these crises, climate change, pandemic, and so on, and try desperately to come up with that one bizarre solution that happens to have the wonderful consequence of holding on to capitalism. Whatever for?
It's interesting because I in your other article at Salon.com, how fascism has converged with capitalism, which is an incredibly heady and terrifying article. I actually highlighted your last sentence, which was, but the tendency of capitalism is towards instability, its cycles, inequality, the upward redistribution of wealth, and fascism, state-capitalist merger. The first 20 years of this new century displays these tendencies in stark relief. And as I'm looking at all those things, I'm thinking, well, what is there to save? Like, what does it fix? What does it fix? And when you're looking at, you know, the number of people that are uninsured and how sick our healthcare system is, and that's basically been wrapped around capitalism, I don't want that system of healthcare, because clearly it just means, you know, how many times I have been uninsured, Professor Wolf? I mean, uninsured 3 or 4 times. I couldn't afford COBRA. I had my first baby born without health insurance, and I found a lump in my breast when I didn't have coverage. I hate the healthcare system in America. And you and I both know, when I read it in your article, it is so wedded to capitalism. We have propped up this failed healthcare system because it is so attached to capitalism.
Absolutely. And think of it this way. We know about pandemics and viruses. There is nothing new about viruses. Viruses are part of nature. They've been with us as long as there have been human beings. Almost certainly much longer than, in fact, human beings. They pre-exist us. We have had terrible viral infections and diseases. You know, I used to teach economic history, and I had a whole series of lectures on the bubonic plague in the 14th century. We know about the unspeakable damage it did. We know about the so-called Spanish flu back in 1918 and the damage it did. We know about SARS and MERS and Ebola. I mean, there is no rational excuse for being unprepared for what you know is coming, which is a virus of this kind. We don't know exactly when, and we don't know the details of each organism, but we know we have to be prepared because we know what the price is to be paid if you're not prepared. And now we are learning yet again what we should have learned umpteen times before. But hold on, the same is true of the business cycle. Capitalism has, for the last 350 years that it's been the growing global system, it has had an economic downturn every 4 to 7 years. Those are the numbers of the National Bureau of Economic Research. They're not my numbers. They're the numbers of the people whose job it is to date and periodize the crisis. Okay, every 4 to 7 years, millions of people are thrown out of work. Thousands of businesses go belly up. Towns and cities don't have any revenue for public services. By the way, a wonderful system. When the private sector crashes and you need to turn to the public sector, you've arranged things such that the public sector doesn't have the money to help you. I mean, again, exactly. You need a lunatic. You need a lunatic to make sense of this kind of an arrangement. But we know we have these crises. Look, we're 20 years into this new century. We had the dot-com crisis in the spring of 2000. We had the subprime mortgage crisis in 2008. We had the COVID-19 crisis in 2020. 20 years, three crises, right in there, 4 to 7 years, just like everywhere else. There is therefore no excuse to have an economy that has no plan. Every time the economy crashes, we're all reading in the Wall Street Journal, oh my God, the economy's in trouble. What? We know it's in trouble. If it's every 4 to 7 years, and the last one was in 2008 and 9, we're overdue for the next one. We didn't need the pandemic. It would have been something else, as it was something else every 4 to 7 years, as far back as anybody alive today can remember. So we failed to be ready for a pandemic we knew was coming, and we failed to be ready for an economic downturn we knew was coming. Okay, that's capitalism's worst nightmare. It has always been. One of the reasons capitalism has always tried to overcome the business cycle, whether it is with government policy, whether it is with an entirely new economic analysis of the sort that John Maynard Keynes produced in the depths of the 1930s, crisis of capitalism. It did that because it understood two things. One, when the economy crashes, people start thinking there might be something wrong with capitalism. So it's an existential threat. But the second is that nightmare, which is, oh my God, imagine if capitalism had an economic downturn and it coincided in time with a climate disaster or a natural disaster or a viral pandemic.
Exactly.
Then you would have two overwhelming crises at the same time. It's unclear that capitalism can survive. Feudalism did not survive the bubonic plague. It was the Renaissance, then there was the Reformation, and then there was the French Revolution, and it was over. My guess is we're going to see something very similar to that as an outgrowth of this exposition of the failures of the capitalist system.
So as I was getting ready for you, I was thinking about who in the world was able to address the pandemic and do it successfully. And the place I went to was South Korea, okay? So I got to ask the question, what does South Korea do from an economic perspective that we don't do? Are they considered a capitalist country? Or are they considered kind of a blend of like a little bit socialist, a little bit communist, a little bit capitalist? I'm just trying to figure out, why is it that South Korea could see the problem at the same time we did, at the same time? And initially their numbers were the same as ours. But when you look at what they've been able to do, they have been wildly successful at addressing this pandemic compared to us. So Right. If we can't depend on capitalism to address a pandemic, what the hell does South Korea have in the way of an economic structure?
Let me answer by pointing out that you're right, but that there are a whole group of countries that fill this description. Okay. If you look at the numbers for Japan, yeah, which in some ways is closer to us, it's a bigger country, it is, you know, it's more similar. They have, I believe, 1,700 dead people. We have 225,000 dead people. I mean, again, or you can look at New Zealand, or you can look at Taiwan, or you can look at Germany. I mean, there are quite a variety of places that have done way better than, you know, Canada, I mean, have done way better than we have. Okay, and I've asked myself the same question. Here's how I would answer the question.
Okay.
Capitalism has produced a contradiction, wherever it has settled, between itself as an economic system and the political system we call universal suffrage. The system in which we say, which had to be fought for, that there ought to be a government that is elected by a voting procedure and that everybody should be allowed to vote. It took a long time, centuries, before people without money could vote, before women could vote, before all kinds of excluded categories. But eventually, both in principle and in practice, universal suffrage, more or less, was created. Universal suffrage is a standing threat to capitalism. And the reason, there's nothing subtle here about it. Capitalism puts in the driver's seat a small minority of the people. We call them capitalists or employers, the people who own and operate businesses and either give us a job or they don't. And then the vast majority are employees. Okay, a universal suffrage means that the employees vastly outnumber the employers.
Exactly.
And it doesn't take a genius to understand that sooner or later, the employees are going to include folks who say, hey, why don't we use our numerical superiority to prevail in an election and use politics to undo the consequences of the capitalist system, namely inequality and all the rest of it, okay? Capitalists have understood this. How do you handle this? You do it in two ways. Number one, you try to buy the political system. In other words, to control the parties, the candidates, the language, so that you can undo the likelihood that the majority are going to get themselves together and make you the enemy. So you disperse that and you make them hate minorities, you make them hate immigrants, whatever you just deflect, disperse, and buy. That's one way.
Right.
But you're all, that's not enough, because there's always the danger that among the employees, there will be people who say they're dividing us to conquer us. They're making scapegoats that we shouldn't pay attention to, etc. So the second defense, here comes the answer to your question.
Okay.
The second defense is to hobble the government, make the government small, make the government weak, make the government dependent on your capitalist okay in lending it money when it's bankrupt, in giving it taxes when it dares to levy them, and develop an ideology that makes the government the bad guy so that everybody doesn't trust it, so that nobody looks to the government for a solution because you've defined the government as the problem.
Right.
That's where libertarianism becomes very useful in this demonization of the government. Okay, and that has worked, let's be fair. In England, in the United States, above all places in the world, that ideology, the demonization of the government, has been very successful in building a strong capitalism. But you know, the thing that helps you in one phase of your life can cripple you in another. You've got to be flexible. The United States and Britain have never been. They remain committed to demonizing the government. And when you do that, you make it impossible for the government to act like a government, to act in such a way that it has the prestige, it has the social position to mobilize private and public resources to solve a problem. The difference in South Korea, in Japan, in Taiwan, in New Zealand, is that they never allowed the demonization of the government to go half as far as it has gone in the United States and England.
Right.
In fact, in those societies, the government, for a whole host of reasons, is generally respected, is genuinely obeyed, is generally looked upon, not altogether justifiably, but is looked upon as an agency of the society as a whole. And it is deferred to in that way.
Right.
So when this pandemic comes, the leaders of South Korea and Japan and New Zealand, who are capitalists, who like capitalism, who support capitalism.
Very much so. That was why my question was, exactly.
Yeah, but they were able to mobilize that government. I mean, give you an example. I was speaking today with a fellow professor who's Japanese or of Japanese origin, and she just came back from Japan. Here's what she told me. She got off the airplane in Japan to visit her mother. You don't go to immigration. You go to the health department in the airport. They make you fill out a questionnaire. They interview you. They give you on the spot a COVID-19 test. You can't go pee in the restroom of the airport until you have gone through. And then, no matter what your test, you are quarantined for 14 days under the supervision. Okay, that's what they do. And all people entering Japan, even people like her who carry a Japanese passport, are required to go through that procedure because that's how they identify anybody carrying the disease, sequester them, give them the treatment they need, but separate them from anybody they could infect. We didn't do any of that. She said she came back from Tokyo, landed at Newark Airport outside of New York City, and, you know, left the airplane, walked through the airport, got in a cab and came back to New York, and nobody bothered her even to put a mask on her face, let alone take any protective action whatsoever. She said that the contrast could not have been starker for her. I mean, she lives in New York City, so this is her home, but here she was, a kind of an illustration. And no one in Japan, that's another sign of it, no one in Japan is marching around the city saying stuff like, you're infringing on my freedom by telling me I have to wear a mask. Because they kind of understand what the logic is and that the government is doing something that is good for everybody. So of course you would do it, since it would be downright perverse not to do it once it's explained to you that the mask impedes the transmission of the disease. And they ask, this has happened to me too, they ask us, what's the matter with your country? Because to them, it looks like mental illness, only on a social scale that they don't understand. You know, they would understand an isolated individual, but you know, and so you know how they explain it, by the way? They explain it, which I think is a mistake, but that's what how they explain it. They blame Mr. Trump. In other words, their explanation is that he models, you know, the hostility to the mask or the hostility to taking the whole thing seriously. And so they've developed a notion that Mr. Trump is the beginning and end of this craziness. And at that point, you know, I get upset because I want them to see that the system is the problem. Mr. Right. Trump is a symptom of a system, not the other way around.
So when I was reading this article about South Korea in anticipation of you, I loved how they referred to their healthcare system. They called it the healthcare security system. They use the word security in the term of art as they were describing how they look at the gestalt of healthcare, which to me made my heart sing. But I want to get back to what you wrote in your article about how fascism has converged with capitalism. And your description of healthcare, I so love you, because I have been saying this for the longest time, because this is an unholy alliance between private health industry and the government. And the government has been manipulated. And the reason the government has been manipulated is to ensure that capitalists and those in the employer situation thrive successfully. And the description of Medicare and Medicaid, I hate, because what did government do? Government said to the private insurance industry, we'll take care of the old people. You don't have to worry about them. We'll take care of the poor people. You don't have to worry about them. We'll take care of the really sick people. You don't have to worry about them. If they're healthy, if they're young, they're yours. So we ate the most expensive part of healthcare. We're not able to spread the risk because the private insurance industry has all those young, healthy people. And what did we say? Not a problem. We'll eat the rest. I mean, talk about the worst of both. Well, actually, the worst of only our world, which is the thing that we pay for is not the most efficient, the most effective, and it's not universal, but it sure as hell costs money. And what did we leave to the private marketplace, to the capitalists? Guess what? The cherry on the sundae. And I was just, I read your, and I've been screaming this story, Professor Wolf, for years and years and years. I said, you know what? And you know what the really sad part is? The only thing that private insurance really wants to insure are young men between the ages of 25 and 35. Because after that, they go into heart attack material. Before that, they're irresponsible and they don't get pregnant. I mean, let's be honest. And we don't talk about that. And that's one of the reasons why all those other countries that you have described it seems that they have used the franchise in a very different way, but they have this sense of community that from the very beginning we have lacked. The idea of the individual has been so pressed into our headset that somehow you can fix things as an individual. And you and I both know you can't fix the roads, you can't fix the water, you can't fix the air, you can't build a business, and that we have to do things collectively. But capitalism doesn't want us to do things collectively because that's the challenge to capitalism.
You know, I agree with you. Let me put on my hat as an economist, right?
Okay, put on your hat.
What they taught me at my various schools that I went to would lead me to ask a simple question. The United States spends more as a share of its GDP on healthcare than any other industrialized country, and no one is even close. It's not just that we're number one, we pay more. Roughly 18% of our GDP goes for healthcare. And the next, I think the number two country, it's around 12 to 14%. I'm not even close. Okay. At the same time that we spend more than everybody else, what are our outcomes? You know, what do we get in a sense for what we pay? The last 3 years, we have had a shrinking longevity. We live less long this year than last year and last year than the year before that. We have a much, let's put it this way. We rank in the middle, very mediocre in terms of medical outcomes. If you measure children who die in the first year of their lives, if you measure the number of days on average that you go spend in a hospital, visits to the doctor, all the measures have been done 100 times. We are mediocre in this country. We're not the worst, but we're closer to the bottom than we are to the top. But we spend more than everybody else. Okay, in economics, that's supposed to let a little red light go off. We're spending way more, but we're not getting an outcome that's commensurate with what we're paying, which suggests we're overpaying.
You think?
Yes. Hello. You know, it's a kind of, how hard is this? And the minute you do this and you discover, okay, well, we have this monopoly, basically.
Yeah.
And I use that example in the article, and I try over and over again to get people who understand what the military industrial complex is and why we end up spending more on our defense than the next 6 countries combined, which is not only because we have a bigger military, that's part of the story, but it's also because we pay more than everybody else to the military producers. But the medical profession figured it out. The 4 industries, doctors, 1, hospitals, 2, drug and device makers, 3, insurance, medical insurance companies, 4. Those 4 got together and agreed to back each other up to squeeze out of the public sector via what you said, Medicare, Medicaid, and all of that, to make themselves a monopoly that could charge what they wanted because the insurers would cover whatever the cost of the Medicare, of the medicine was, and they would cover the cost of the device, and they would do all of that, and they work in cahoots with one another. The only difference is that if you think about it, the government of the United States wants to be prepared militarily. So what does it do? It goes to these 4 industries and it says, we need to have stockpiled missiles, guns, rockets, bombs. And so we will buy them from you right off the assembly line, pay you a good price, give you a fat profit, and then we, the government, will take the responsibility to go store it in warehouses, to monitor it, to make sure it has the right temperature and humidity, and if it wears out, to replace it. Very, very expensive, all done at the government's expense. So the question you might wonder about is, why was that not done
for health
by the medical industrial complex? In other words, why not have the government come in and buy 400 million masks and have them available if a pandemic, and, you know, 1 million ventilators and 1 million gloves and, you know, all the paraphernalia? They didn't do it. The private companies didn't make those things. because it's not profitable to sit and hold them in a warehouse for who knows how many years. So they didn't do it. And so the government would have had to do it if it was going to be done. But the government didn't do it. And then here's the explanation, because I think you'll find it remarkable. The explanation is they can't, because they have demonized the government as the agency of socialized medicine. And they can't bring the government in, because inadvertently that will reinforce the notion that, gee, the government should be doing the medical care in our, that's so scary to them, so frightening as the end of their great monopoly, that they can't have the government do for them what would be profitable, because it's too dangerous to their social situation. So they look in bitter jealousy at the military producers who get that, and they can't avail themselves of the same, even though a part of them would dearly love to be able to do it.
Professor Wolf, his new book, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. And if you want to at least go to Salon.com, check out his article, Capitalism is the Reason COVID-19 is Ravaging America. We're calling you again. I'm just telling you right now. I never took you as a professor, but I'll bring you on the radio and I'll take the course. So thank you so much for joining us, Professor Wolf. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. And good to see you, Ken, and know that you too survived the schools that tried so hard to turn us in another direction.
Right. Well, Joe Stiglitz was the main teacher of the orthodox micro and macroeconomics till a bunch of us questioned the basis of that, and he went elsewhere.
Yes, he did.
All right. And on that note, thank you so much, Professor Wolf.
My pleasure, and let's do it again in the future.
All right, Joe. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thanks.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnison and Ken Barnes. We'll be right back. Republican or Democrat, the labels just don't matter. When our government's for sale and served up on a silver platter, with corporations influencing all our legislation, don't you think it's about time we push for stricter regulation? We want to be free from corporate greed. We need to get out from under their thumb. We want to be free from corporate greed. Right now might be the hour for the people to take back their power. Our politicians cater to the richest 1%, while the rest of us can't figure where their bailout money went. The banks enjoy protections of their personal rights, but if they're the ones making the rules, then how are we to fight? We want to be free from corporate greed. We need to get out from under their thumb. We want to be free from corporate greed. Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnison and producer Ken Barnes. So, like, I got a government executive, and I see this article and I'm like, the headline goes, Trump's order sets the stage for loyalty tests for thousands of feds. Now, this doesn't surprise me, but it is now the idea of a loyalty test being spread across the entire bureaucracy. And I knew that everyone had to kiss his ring in order to be part of his sort of senior staff, and then it might've trickled down to a certain layer. But this was something that was, I think, incredibly shocking. So I said, I got to post this on Facebook. I got to grab the guy that wrote this article. And just before he joins us on the air, another headline comes out of Politico. Trump federal salary advisor quits post over executive order reclassifying workers. The executive order stripped job protections for many federal workers in a move that unions and Democrats denounced. Well, actually, more than unions and Democrats, the fact that the advisor, the salary advisor, quit and actually said why speaks even more about how horrific this is. Joining us right now is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Donald Kettle is located at the LBJ Washington Center. He is the author of many books, including his newest book, The Divided State of America. And Donald, this was a great article. I read it, I posted it, I pulled clips out of it. So what I want you to do for my audience is to explain not exactly what Donald Trump did with this executive order, but what is the, up until this executive order, what was the current state of hiring and firing within these bureaucracies? And why is this something that is not only so threatening, but that it would even cause someone who is a Trump appointee, the federal salary advisor, to quit and to be honest in his letter of resignation why he was quitting? A lot of people say, I'm going to spend time with my family. He did not say that. He basically sort of put the finger of blame at Donald Trump and said, this is horrific. So one, welcome to the program. And two, talk to us a little bit about what existed before the executive order and why this is something that is so frightening.
And Arnie, that's a great question. And thanks so much for the chance to be on your show and to be able to talk about this issue, because this is one very big deal. Mm-hmm. And the reason has to do, for just maybe a 30-second history lesson on this, once upon a time, we didn't have a merit system in the United States. And every time a new president were elected, he would come in, and along with that would come a group of new political appointees, and they would want to bring in all their cronies. It was back in the good old days of the spoils system. And this spoils system actually was wonderful in one respect. It gave presidents the chance to bring lots of loyalists along with them. It was terrible in another respect, which was that it made it impossible to be able to build expertise in government to do the really important and complicated things the government was trying to do back in the good old days of the 19th century when they created this. Things like finding ways of regulating the railroads, finding ways of beginning to regulate the health and safety of food. And they sort of thought it was a good idea to bring people in who were experts, whose job it would be to provide politically impartial advice and counsel and help to implement policy in a politically neutral way, regardless of who was elected. So that the basic idea was that if a new president came in, they would give their advice, the president would have the authority to be able to make the call, they would execute it in a politically impartial way, but also the president would get the benefit of having the best possible expertise. And to be able to make that possible, we created basic protections that ensured that we hired people based on merit, based on what they knew and not who they knew. And we created protections against just firing them for arbitrary reasons, like saying inconvenient or perhaps controversial things. And so that was the foundation. And what we've done with the executive order in the president's mind is to make it easier to sweep people in any kind of policy role into a new federal schedule, and from there make it easier to dismiss them. And so we've shifted back to the good old days of the spoils system, which increases loyalty, but on the other hand, really puts the concept of merit and expertise at risk in the federal government.
So as I'm listening to you, I wrote down two things. The value of people being there for a long time. One, because they came in because they had this expertise, is that what you have is the muscle of institutional memory. And that is so important, because what that means is, I mean, this is not our first rodeo with the pandemic, maybe of this consequence and this size, but like Dr. Fauci. Dr. Fauci is an example of someone who's been around and around and around. And so he brings with him a level of expertise and an institutional memory that's valuable. But Fauci isn't alone in this. There are other people within the bureaucracies who have also been there for decades and also carry that level of expertise. And they also have that memory. That is so important. The other thing that's so important, and the other word I wrote down, is trust. And that is that if you want the American people to trust the FDA, to trust the CDC, to trust whoever, the EPA, they need to get a sense that the people that are sort of laying these policies out, that are giving you these policy prescriptions, that are sort of evaluating them, are people that do come in because of their expertise, because of their institutional memory, because they really are giving you the facts, not the massaged facts or the cherry-picked facts or the facts that the boss wants. They're giving you the freaking facts. And to a large extent, this executive order so mirrors exactly who Donald Trump is. because he doesn't want the memory. He doesn't want the trust. And the last thing he believes in is facts. So what he gets to do is really drain the system. And if you are worried about the erosion of things called policy and government, he has just expedited it by this executive order.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's such a huge problem. And let me pick at each of those issues that you just raised. One is expertise. It's not only the fact that Tony Fauci has been around forever and knows more about the issues about dealing with an infectious disease than any of us could possibly ever pick up. And when we get to a sub-situation, I would want him in my corner because I would want him to try to help figure out how to deal with this. But it's not only him, but it's the army of researchers who have been working on this for a really, really, really long time. This is not their first time at the rodeo, and this is not their first rodeo. And so they really need to be able to bring to the president at least a series of options that the president can choose or not, but at least to make sure the president's not blindsided by, oh, wow, I didn't think of that, because they have. And they've thought about it because they've had a chance to be able to understand this. And it's not just in things like the pandemic, but suppose, for example, that we had a terrorist leader that we wanted to try to take out. And suppose that we wanted to try to figure out where he might be hiding, about what kind of forces we might need to get him, how many helicopters, how many soldiers, whether or not to bring a dog along, what kind of ammunition they need, how to sneak in, how many refueling planes you need. That's the story, of course, of going in to try to get bin Laden, which we did, and we only did because there were people around who knew how to do that. And so it's one thing for the president to say, I want to take out bin Laden. It's another thing to have people who know how to do it. And so the expertise is incredibly important in that, in air traffic control, and managing Medicare, and making sure that the national forests are taken care of. Wherever it is that you look, it turns out that some of the best experts in the world work for the federal government doing these things. And then the other question is a question of trust. As all this stuff happens, the basic question is, do we trust the people who are doing it? And somebody says that the medication that I'm taking is safe. We really trust the Food and Drug Administration for making the judgment on that to tell us that it's safe, and we have to believe them. When it turns out that somebody says that the hurricane is coming right for us and you need to evacuate, leave your home behind, I mean, do you trust them enough to be able to make the call, get in the car, leave your possessions behind and run for your life? You're not going to do it if you don't trust the people who are making that decision. Or when it comes time for deciding what kind of treatment that you ought to get for a serious illness and you're on Medicare, and you have to ask whether or not Medicare is going to cover it, do you trust the decisions of the people who are making that call? And one of the things we don't want is to assume that the people who are making that decision are doing it for political reasons. And so the combination of expertise on the one hand and trust on the other are about as important a combination as you can get. And by pulling the rug out from underneath both of those, we have serious problems, I think, that are likely to flow from this new executive order.
I'm going to read from the resignation letter of the Trump federal salary advisor because I want my audience to hear his words. So here's what he writes. I have concluded that as a matter of conscience, I can no longer serve him or his administration, he writes. It is clear that its stated purpose, the stated purpose of the executive order, notwithstanding, is nothing more than a smokescreen for what is clearly an attempt to require the political loyalty of those who advise the president, or failing that, to enable their removal with little, if any, due process. Now, I just want to tell people, this is shocking what he wrote. I mean, it's one thing to resign, I get it. But to resign with such an emphatic exclamation point that points the finger of blame, that says exactly what you said in your article at Government Executive, and to say it in, I mean, given his authority and his knowledge, he knows exactly what Donald Trump is doing, and he said it as he left and slammed the door. My question to you is, one, how the hell does he get away with this kind of an executive order? Can it be challenged, number one? Number two, why did he do it now? Is he planning on, if he loses, he's going to drain the system before he like leaves the office in January? Or if he wins, he's basically preparing for his role as despot in chief? Because he's clearly making sure that nobody is going to trust anything coming out of the government unless, in fact, you genuflect to the president. I'm just trying to figure out, is there a challenge and why?
Good set of questions. The first is it legal?
Yes.
And there are different opinions on this so far. It turns out that Congress over the years has delegated an enormous amount of power to the president to set up the personnel system. There are ways in which it could be challenged. There are those who have told me already that they think it's probably unlikely those challenges would be successful. Other people think they might be able to find a way to be able to do it. One of the things that is hidden in all of this is the president is asserting his ability to be able to change existing federal regulations by fiat through executive order without having to go through the standard processes that require the president to tell people in advance what he's up to and about what the proposals are and giving people a chance to be able to respond. That's a very big deal. It's possible that it could be overturned on that, but it's going to be a very difficult set of legal questions. Second question is, why now? And the answer is that they've been at this actually for a while. This is something that has been literally years and years and years in the making, because there's a group of folks working for think tanks, especially in Washington, who have concluded that the federal civil service is simply unresponsive and in some cases incompetent, or at least those who are poor performers can't easily be removed. And so that's something that has to be changed. They're convinced that it creates a kind of deep state that is resistant to the views of political officials, so that they thought that they needed to have a fundamental transformation. They've been working at this through the course of the Trump administration. They're deeply embedded in the Domestic Policy Council in the White House, and they're the ones who are responsible for this. So that leads us now to, where does this go from here? Down one of two roads. If it turns out that the Trump administration continues and Trump wins on Tuesday, then what we're likely to see is more of the same of this, because it shows very clearly the direction in which the administration intends to go. And the implications are broad and sweeping and fly in the face of 140 years of both tradition and law and policy embraced by members of both parties. If Biden wins, on the other hand, creates at least the possibility for stirring up a lot of dust by the Trump administration on the way out and possibly sweeping a fair number of federal employees into this new system. And then there's a provision in the executive order that prevents people from being fired for political reasons. So they may be brought in for political reasons, but then it would be difficult for Biden to dismiss them if the reason that he gave was because they were Trump appointees or brought in to side with the Trump administration on policy, so that it creates a double problem. One is getting people into the system, and the second is then once they're in and brought in for political favoritism to make it difficult to displace them. This is sweeping in lots of ways.
Oh, Don, nobody has actually focused on that second question. That is, so it's amazing. So he's brilliant. He brings them in politically, and then he boxes Biden in and says, but I get to do the politics stuff, you don't. You know, which is in a way, evil genius. And I want to go back to something you said about, you know, regulations and how they want to sort of either dismantle them or whatever. By putting in his appointees, he has dismantled regulations. And here's how. We know something called prosecutorial discretion. So you may have a law, you may have a series of laws. You get to decide, you know, the force and effect of that law by how aggressive you're going to be, whether you ignore this, oh, I'll get to that one next week, I'll do this one first. And what he's doing is, if he can't even change regulations by the people he's putting in, if they're not vigorous in enforcing these regulations, he's won. They may be on the books, but something on the books that nobody ever sees enforced ain't on the books. I mean, let's be honest here. So in a lot of ways, I think people need to understand how horrific this is and toxic this is, because it isn't just personnel, because personnel is policy. Personnel is policy. He may not have learned that, but guess what? The people around him know that, and they will make sure that the policy they want is the policy that is effective, and the policy they don't, oh my God, they forget to actually enforce it.
And there's so many ways in which we tend to think about personnel policies being so boring, and we'll get on to the policy questions. But as you suggest, Arnie, personnel is policy, and it's policy in a couple of different ways. First, it's a question of what's a problem? What is it that you decide that you want to take on? Then how hard do you push on the problem? And how high a priority do you make it? Which things do you make not a priority and push in the background? What kind of options do you consider? How hard do you push on those options? How successful are you at carrying them out? Do you have the expertise to be able to make that work? How much do you stick with it for the long haul? How uniformly do you try to pursue this in different places? Or how much do you allow people in other places to pull the threads to tug it apart? And those are all questions that depend on the personnel of the people who are involved in making those decisions. And the thing that's important about this is that this is not just an issue of putting a few political favorites into key plum positions at the top of agencies. This is written in a way that would extend this new executive schedule into anyone having to do with a policy making or policy informing kind of decision, which goes down very, very, very deeply. Somebody at the CDC who's working in Atlanta doing an analysis of whether or not wearing a mask is likely to prevent the spread of the disease, who is just a GS9, fairly low-level person doing a basic background paper, could be somebody who is viewed as having a policymaking role swept up into this. And if they write things that are viewed as inconvenient, they could then be dismissed at will.
Well, and what you said in your article is that what's brilliant about this executive order is its simplicity. It's not complicated, and yet it should be void for vagueness. But in fact, its vagueness is part of its simplicity, which means it can cover so many more people than one would imagine. And again, having worked in government and having run for office, I want people to understand, you know how you know the story about like one rotten apple like ruins the bushel? So you don't need to have a critical, you have a critical mass of people that suddenly sort of are now genuflecting to the president. And even if there are other people within the system that want to play by the rules, that have a level of expertise, because they are now surrounded by people that have this level of relationship with the administration and the appointment, they are disincentivized to actually be aggressive in their work. In fact, they see that as perhaps a liability for them. So it's not just the rot of the people that he's appointing, it's that the rot infiltrates the entire system.
Well, and the problem is, think about this. You're working for an agency, a problem comes up. There's something that you see based on your experience that you think might be an issue. Do you dare step forward? Yes. And if you think that your job is going to be at risk because you're saying things that are inconvenient or not welcome, then you may decide, well, I'm just not going to bring that up. Right. Or because you know that if you did, somebody else who did lost their job over it. The risk of doing that is that there are lots of ways of being able to get into big trouble. One is, I used to tell a story about a new person comes into the job. There are two big ways that you can get the new person in trouble. The first is that you do nothing about what they want. The second is you do everything about what they want, because the worst mistake that somebody can make coming in is just to give orders and people blindly follow them and not alert them to the fact that, you know, if you do this, you may want to be careful because you may launch a new website for a new healthcare system that doesn't work. And so you end up with problems of people who tell you what it is that you want to hear. And if people are not going to voice the issues and the problems, we run the risk of undermining the very expertise that we depend on to get complicated jobs done.
Scary. I know, Ken, you wanted to weigh in.
Well, I was very troubled to hear you say, Don, that Biden wouldn't be able to fire the new people that Trump hires, because I thought one of the problems with this whole new executive order was that Trump would be able to fire anybody for almost no reason. So how would Biden be precluded? But then I was thinking that if Trump hires a bunch more people, aren't they going to be on probation for a while? And as probationary civil servants, aren't they going to be terminable until they've shown that they can do the job for 6 months or so?
Well, what's complicated about this is we don't know exactly what the new executive order is going to be and how it's going to work. The challenge is that we don't have much in the way of details on this to be able to understand. But the idea of probationary civil servants for people who were part of this new schedule would be a non sequitur, because there wouldn't be such a thing. You're either in the system and therefore subject to at-will employment and at-will dismissal or not. And so what could happen is that you could have large numbers of people, how many? I mean, tens of thousands, possibly even hundreds of thousands, who are defined as being part of this new schedule. And once they are, because they're involved in policy activities, they could be dismissed at will because of the decision of supervisors. What is not clear is what kind of protections they may have, and in particular, whether or not they could be dismissed. But the executive order seems to be written in a way that would prohibit dismissal, at least purely on the grounds of their political affiliation. So all this is complicated. It's at least putting some landmines into the system that make it difficult for the Biden people to come in and reverse it. Now, what's likely is that if Biden is elected, there will be a pile of papers as he comes off the dais at the inauguration for him to sign, some of which would be repealing and reversing the executive orders, among other things. But the Trump administration, clearly, they're in a mad rush right now to put as much of this into place as they possibly can, one way or another between now and January, including the possibility of creating this new system and getting people into it before Inauguration Day. So it makes it at the very least that much more complicated to unwind. So they're madly rushing to try to do as much as they can in the meantime.
But also Trump's going to get rid of all the people who actually know what they're doing, who have been doing this kind of work for decades or whatever through different administrations, Republican and Democratic. And if Trump cleans house in the federal agencies, then Biden's not going to be able to find all the people to hire him back. He's going to be left with a ghost town.
I think he can. I think they'll leave their resumes everywhere.
They'll do that. But the problem is that there are some people I know, because I've talked to some of them, who are saying, you know what, this is just such chaos. I'm getting close to retirement. I think maybe I've had enough. On the other hand, I've talked to students who are thinking about the idea of making a career in federal service. And they're saying, oh, this is so crazy. Maybe I'm going to look for a job someplace else. So it's the problem of being able to get new people in and keep the good people that you've got, that in many ways is some of the most pernicious, even if in fact nobody gets fired. It's just stirring things up so much that makes it so difficult to maintain the talent that we have and that we need. And if you look around at the complicated issues that we face, from climate change to defense policy to health to issues having to do with weather forecasting and air traffic control, you can't look anywhere that the federal government touches that is not full of really complicated things that need really smart people to solve them. And it's the difficulty of getting a good match between that talent and those problems that in many ways is the most pernicious part of this.
So I want to go back to the title of your article. Trump's order sets the stage for loyalty tests for thousands of feds. Then I want to go back to the leaving letter by the head of the agency who says, I have concluded that as a matter of conscience, I can no longer work for this administration. It is clear that its stated purpose, notwithstanding, is that it's nothing more than a smokescreen for what is clearly an attempt to require the political loyalty of those who advise the president, or failing that, to enable their removal with little, if any, due process. So he hasn't set the stage. I think this guy knows that the stage has been set, the curtain has been pulled, and we're all seeing it for what it is. Don Kettle, you are wonderful. I'm so glad you're paying attention to this. The idea of the shackles being put on Biden when he gets elected, or if he gets elected, given this executive order, is something I haven't heard talked about. So you've just added a new wrinkle into this executive order that I so appreciate. And of course, you are a professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Please join us again and keep your eye on what's going to happen over the course of the next couple of weeks, because Donald Trump wants to blow things up. And he will be putting minefields everywhere. And there's so much chaos going on that people like you have to keep your eye on these things, because we may miss them. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much, Arnie. It's so good to have a chance to be with you and your audience to talk about these important issues.
All right, ciao. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You bet. Hey.